The tabernacle was the place from which God would govern Israel. The cherubim form a throne for the invisible Yahweh. Later, when the tent of the most holy place was moved into the temple, two giant cherubim were installed within for Yahweh's throne, making the ark his footstool. Lastly, as Beal notes, the entrance to Eden was from the east, which was also the direction from which one entered the tabernacle, and later the temples of Israel. Genesis 2:12 says that good gold and delium and onyx stone were in the land of Havilah, apparently where Eden was. Of course, various items of tabernacle furniture were made of gold, as were the walls, ceiling, and floor of the Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple. Sacrifice and Israel's Cosmic Geography. One Israelite ritual in particular illustrates realm distinction. In the context of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, which has the nations under the dominion of lesser gods, the entire Israelite camp was cosmic geography and sacred space. Israel was identified with Yahweh. Both the people and the land that Yahweh had determined would belong to the descendants of Abraham were Yahweh's portion. The Day of Atonement ritual provides a fascinating convergence of these ideas. Part of that ritual's description goes like this. And Aaron shall take the two goats, and he shall present them before Yahweh at the tent of assembly's entrance. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for Yahweh, and one for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat on which the lot for Yahweh fell, and he shall sacrifice it as a sin offering. But he must present alive before Yahweh the goat on which the lot for Azazel fell, to make atonement for himself, to send it away into the desert to Azazel. Why is one of the goats for Azazel? Who or what is Azazel? The passage is inexplicable unless you're acquainted with the cosmic geographical ideas we've been talking about. The word Azazel in the Hebrew text can be translated the goat that goes away. This is the justification for the common scapegoat translation in some English versions. The scapegoat, so the translator has it, symbolically carries the sins of the people away from the camp of Israel into the wilderness. Seems simple enough. However, Azazel is really a proper name. In Leviticus 16:8, one goat is for Yahweh, while the other goat is for Azazel. Since Yahweh is a proper name and the goats are described in the same way, Hebrew parallelism informs us that Azazel is also a proper name. What needs resolution is what it means. Azazel is regarded as the name of a demon in the Dead Sea Scrolls and other ancient Jewish books. In fact, in one scroll, Azazel is the leader of the angels that sinned in Genesis 6, 1-4. The same description appears in the book of 1 Enoch. Recall that in intertestamental Judaism, the offending sons of God from Genesis 6 were believed to have been imprisoned in a pit or abyss in the netherworld. Azazel's realm was somewhere out in the desert, outside the confines of holy ground. It was a place associated with supernatural evil. The Old Testament itself does not state that Azazel was a demon. Scholars have, however, connected the name to Mot, the god of death. The identification of the term with a demon may also derive from cosmic geography and an association of the wilderness with the forces of chaos, which are hostile to God. This would make sense on several levels, as the desert would not only be a place forbidding to life, but, as ground outside the camp of Israel and Yahweh, the source of life, would have a clear association with chaos. Leviticus 17:7 suggests that Israelites saw the desert as spiritually sinister. So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices to goat demons after whom they whore. We are not told why they did this, but the placement of this problem in proximity to the ritual goat to Azazel suggests a conceptual connection. Jews of later periods certainly made such connections. Note: J.B. Lightfoot notes how Jewish practice came to involve pushing the goat for Azazel over a cliff to ensure the sins of the nation never found their way back to holy ground. When they set forth the goat, Azazel, on the day of expiation, the person attending the goat snapped the scarlet thread into two parts, of which he bound one to the horns of the goat and the other to the rock, and thrust the goat down, which, hardly coming to the middle of the precipice, was dashed and broken into pieces. The fifth tractate of the Talmud and the Mishnah describes the goat's fate in Yoma 6.6. End note. In the Day of Atonement ritual, the goat for Yahweh, the goat that was sacrificed, purges the impurities caused by the people of Israel and purifies the sanctuary. The goat for Azazel was sent away after the sins of the Israelites were symbolically placed on it. The point of the goat for Azazel was not that something was owed to the demonic realm as though a ransom were being paid. Note. Some theologians use Azazel in Leviticus 16 to support what is called the ransom theory of the atonement. This theory argues that the Day of Atonement ought to be viewed as an offering of a ransom to Satan, and not as a substitutionary atonement that satisfies the wrath of God. Since the Day of Atonement prefigures the atoning sacrifice of Christ, it is argued that Jesus' life was a ransom paid to Satan. The ransom theory is implicitly put forward in C.S. Lewis's classic The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where the death of Aslan is a payment owed to the White Witch. End note. The goat for Azazel banished the sins of the Israelites to the realm outside Israel. Why? Because the ground on which Yahweh had his dwelling was holy. Sin had to be transported to where evil belonged, the territory outside Israel, under the control of the gods set over the pagan nations. The high priest was not sacrificing to Azazel. Rather, Azazel was getting what belonged to him, sin. The concept of realm distinction and cosmic geography go hand in hand. Every day, ancient Israel's journey to the Promised Land reiterated some point in regard to who they were and their purpose on earth. The invisible Yahweh and the visible Yahweh were present as cloud and angel, leading his people through the domain of hostile gods and their people to Israel's own divinely allotted home. When they were camped, the glow of Yahweh's fire over the tabernacle, Eden returned to earth, illumined the camp. They were Yahweh's portion. The forces of chaos, seen and unseen, were on every border. One would think the living object lessons would have ensured faith when it came time to confront those forces. But that wasn't to be. Section Summary. The judgment at Babel made the world a very different place. Before Yahweh's disinheritance of the nations, he had been in covenant relationship with all the descendants of Noah. God had told Noah's sons to be fruitful and multiply and overspread the earth. It's no accident that these were also the words given to Adam and Eve. The sons of Noah were to expand God's human family and carry on the original goal of an Edenic world. Babel undermined all that. In response, Yahweh made the nations outsiders. If his will was too burdensome, then they could serve other gods. Yahweh would transfer the Edenic dream to someone else, a people who didn't yet exist, but soon would. Yahweh came to Abraham in human form just as he had with Adam and Eve. The contact was personal because the interest was personal. Yahweh's kingdom rule would be built on covenant loyalty. He would remain faithful, and beginning with Abraham, all who wished to participate could do so if they, like Abraham, believed the covenant promises and turned away from the other gods. The promises would pass from Abraham to Isaac, and then to Jacob, Israel. Yahweh's family would be preserved through Joseph and delivered through Moses. The deliverance, of course, was a means to an end. Yahweh wanted what he had wanted from the beginning, a mingling of his heavenly and earthly families on the earth he had called into existence. To that end, he brought Israel home to Sinai. One element of the original pact with Abraham had come to pass. Israel was numerous. But as yet Israel's people had no land and had yet to fulfill the role of blessing the nations, drawing them back to the one who had cast them aside. One task therefore remained. Yahweh would bring Israel to Canaan, where these two covenantal promises would be fulfilled. He would also live among them in that land. To those ends, the covenant for living in the presence of God, remaining in the land, and being a kingdom of priests was enacted in the presence of witnesses, Yahweh's divine counsel. When his people were threatened, whether by gods or men, Yahweh would intervene visibly as the angel in a burning bush, the embodied name leading Israel through the wilderness, and the commander of Yahweh's forces on the field of battle. In a conflict between gods and men, Israel was hopelessly outnumbered, but had the God who mattered. All that was needed was believing loyalty, trust, and obey. What could go wrong? Part 5. Conquest and Failure. Chapter 23. Giant Problems. Reviewing what we had discussed in an earlier chapter, God had told Eve that her offspring would be locked in conflict with those of the serpent. The serpent was actually a divine being, not a mere member of the animal kingdom. While the flexibility of the meaning of the term, Nahash, forces us to consider double, even triple, entendre, one thing is quite clear. The divine being in the garden, who rebelled against Yahweh's desire to have humans rule an Edenic world, is never cast in human form. Note. Recall that the Satan of Job 1-2 was not the enemy of Eden. The Nahash is never called Satan in the Hebrew Bible, and no passage in the Old Testament where the word Satan is used to describe a divine being ever uses Nahash as part of that description. It is also not clear from the language of Job 1-2 whether the Satan is one of the sons of God or just makes an appearance among the sons of God. End note. Unlike the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1-4, who are cast as assuming human flesh and capable of cohabitation, the divine rebel of Eden does not appear to Eve that way. Note. As we saw earlier, the creaturely portrayal is consistent with the use of the term cherub to describe the Edenic enemy. Cherubim were divine creaturely guardians of the God's throne. A human portrayal of the divine beings, sons of God, in Genesis 6 is also required because of the parallel to and polemic against the Mesopotamian Apkallus, see chapter 13. The discussion in this and the next two chapters will introduce readers to a second interpretive approach to Genesis 6, 1-4 that does not require literal divine-human cohabitation, but nevertheless does require a supernatural view of the sons of God. This alternative perspective is consistent with understanding the human offspring as the focus of Genesis 6, 1-4, while understanding offspring of the creaturely Nahash metaphorically. End note. Consequently, the idea of a seed or offspring extending from the Nahash would not have been literal for the biblical writer. Instead, the notion is metaphorical or spiritual. And this is precisely what we see when the phrase occurs elsewhere in the Bible. The metaphor is perhaps most clear in the New Testament, when Jesus himself referred to the Pharisees as serpents, who were of their father, the devil. Note. The Old Testament uses the metaphor as well. The oracle against the Philistines, for example, threatens that roguish nation with the root of the snake, Nahash. Isaiah 14:29. The word translated root, shoresh, is used in the very next verse to describe the Philistine people who will be the victims of this judgment. God's executing judgment on the Philistines by means of another human enemy is expressed metaphorically with serpent language. That the word shoresh, root, speaks of human offspring is perhaps best known from the phrase root of Jesse, to refer to the Messiah. End note. Despite the metaphorical nature of the language in the Eden story, the idea of divine beings producing human spawn who would oppose Yahweh's desires does appear in Genesis 6, 1-4. That passage in turn becomes grist for the biblical writers and their descriptions of the conquest of Canaan. In this and the next two chapters, we'll recapture their thinking on that part of biblical Israel's history. The expulsion of Adam and Eve was followed by a series of episodes that pitted the descendants of Eve against the spiritual children of the original enemy. The opposition to God's plan came in both human and divine form. Cain was referenced specifically in this light, 1 John 3:12. Cain, who was of the evil one and violently murdered his brother. Genesis 6, 1-4 explicitly described a transgression of the domain boundary between heaven and earth that God wanted observed. Then there was the rebellion at Babel. More review. Israel was reborn as a nation in the Exodus from Egypt. After receiving the law, building the tabernacle, and establishing the priesthood, they departed for the promised land. They soon arrived at the border of Canaan, where Moses sent 12 spies to reconnoiter the territory. The spies returned with confirmation of the abundance and desirability of the land. Nevertheless, most of them were in despair. The land was occupied by people in walled cities, some of whom were giants descended from the Nephilim. So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." Numbers 13:32-33. Understanding the trauma of Israel in Numbers 13 is essential to understanding the subsequent conquest accounts. Any Israelite or Jew living after the time of the completion of the Hebrew Bible would have processed the wars for the Promised Land in terms of this passage, since it connected Israel's survival as the people of Yahweh with the defeat of the Nephilim descendants. Nephilim before the flood. In our earlier discussions about Genesis 6, 1-4, we left some questions unaddressed. Note: the issues related to Genesis 6, 1-4 and the conquest accounts are complex. Several issues are discussed in the ensuing material in the next two chapters. However, see the companion website for greater detail, especially with regard to matters of grammar and syntax. End note. How do we understand the note in Genesis 6:4 that the Nephilim were upon the earth at the time of the flood and also afterward? How do we process their original presence? As our earlier discussion made clear, viewpoints that strip the account of its supernatural flavor must be discarded. The events described in Genesis 6, 1-4 were part of Israel's supernatural worldview. We cannot pretend they saw things as most modern readers would. Since the Nephilim were part of Israel's supernatural worldview, and their descendants turn out to be Israel's primary obstacle for conquering the Promised Land, the conquest itself must also be understood in supernatural terms. There are two possible approaches to the origin of the Nephilim in Genesis 6, 1-4, that are consistent with the supernatural understanding of the sons of God in the Israelite worldview. The first and most transparent is that divine beings came to earth, assumed human flesh, cohabited with human women, and spawned unusual offspring known as Nephilim. Naturally, this view requires seeing the giant clans encountered in the conquest as physical descendants of the Nephilim. Note: it is important to note that this view must also conclude that the Nephilim were human despite their unusual size. See the discussion in the notes in chapter 25. End note. The primary objection to this approach is the sexual component. Note: the result of the cohabitation, or some other form of divine intervention per the ensuing discussion, is also something that causes hesitation. The information obtainable from the text of Scripture and archaeology leads to the conclusion that neither the Nephilim nor their descendants were freakishly tall. The evidence points to the same range for unusually tall people today, the upper 6-foot range to 8 feet, see chapter 25. The size of Og's bed, in Deuteronomy 3:11, cannot be taken as a precise indication of Og's own dimensions. See the discussion in chapter 24. End note. The modern enlightened mind simply can't tolerate it. Appeal is usually made to Matthew 22:23-33. In this regard, under the assumption that verse 30 teaches that angels cannot engage in sexual intercourse. On that day, Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came up to him and asked him, saying, Teacher, Moses said if someone dies without having children, his brother is to marry his wife and father descendants for his brother. Now, there were 7 brothers with us, and the first died after getting married, and because he did not have descendants, he left his wife to his brother. So also the second, and the third, up to the 7th. And last of all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife of the 7 will she be? For they all had her as wife. But Jesus answered and said to them, You are mistaken, because you do not know the Scriptures or the power of God. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven. Now concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what is spoken to you by God, who said, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob? He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the crowds heard this, they were amazed at his teaching. Matthew 22:23-33. The text does not say angels cannot have sexual intercourse. It says they don't. The reason ought to be obvious. The context for the statement is the resurrection, which refers either broadly to the afterlife or, more precisely, to the final renewed global Eden. The point is clear in either option. In the spiritual world, the realm of divine beings, there is no need for procreation. Procreation is part of the embodied world and is necessary to maintain the physical population. In like manner, life in the perfected Edenic world also does not require maintaining the human species by having children. Everyone has an immortal resurrection body. Consequently, there is no need for sex in the resurrection, just as there is no need for it in the non-human spiritual realm. But Genesis 6 doesn't have the spiritual realm or the final Edenic world as its context. The analogy breaks down completely. The passage in Matthew is therefore useless as a commentary on Genesis 6:1-4. Despite the flawed use of this gospel passage, Christians still balk at this interpretive option for Genesis 6:1-4. The ancient reader would have had no problem with it. But for moderns, it seems impossible that a divine being could assume human flesh and do what this passage describes. The objection is odd, since this interpretation is less dramatic than the incarnation of Yahweh as Jesus Christ. How is the virgin birth of God as man more acceptable? What isn't mind-blowing about Jesus having both a divine and human nature fused together? For that matter, what doesn't offend the modern scientific mind about God going through a woman's birth canal and enduring life as a human, having to learn how to talk, walk, eat with a spoon, be potty trained, and go through puberty? All these things are far more shocking than Genesis 6:1-4, and yet this is what Scripture explicitly affirms when it informs us that the second person of the Godhead became a man. God became a man from conception onward. The truth is that Christians affirm the incarnation because they have to. It defines Christianity. Genesis 6:1-4 is set aside as peripheral. But belief in a personal God, as the Bible describes, means embracing the supernatural. For the Christian, the high point of the supernatural story of Scripture, its most dramatic and unthinkable expression, is the incarnation of God in Christ. The notion that the sons of God came to earth in fleshly form ought to be more palatable than the incarnation, since it is less supernaturally spectacular. There is no suggestion that any corporeal appearance of a divine being was accomplished through incarnation, becoming an actual human. All such instances are lesser than the incarnation. This particular supernatural approach to Genesis 6, 1-4, derives from other passages that plainly have divine beings, angels, in embodied human form. For example, Genesis 18-19 is quite clear that Yahweh himself and two other divine beings met with Abraham in physical flesh. They ate a meal together. Genesis 19:10 informs us that the two angels had to physically grab Lot and pull him back into his house to avoid harm in Sodom, something that would be hard to do if the two beings were not truly physical. Another example we looked at earlier is Genesis 32:22-31, where we read that Jacob wrestled with a man, whom the text also describes as Elohim twice. Hosea 12:3-4 refers to this incident and describes the being who wrestled with Jacob as Elohim and Malak, angel. This was a physical struggle, one that left Jacob injured. While visual appearances in human form are more common, the New Testament also describes episodes where angels are best understood as corporeal. In Matthew 4:11, angels came to Jesus after he was tempted by the devil and ministered to him. Surely this means more than floating around before Jesus' face. Angels appear and speak, instances that presume actual sound waves being created. If a merely auditory experience was meant, one would expect the communication to be described as a dream vision. Angels open doors and hit disciples to wake them up. This particular episode is especially interesting because the text has Peter mistakenly thinking the angel was only a vision. There is a second supernaturalist approach to Genesis 6, 1-4 that takes the sexual language as euphemistic, not literal. In this perspective, the language of cohabitation is used to convey the idea that divine beings, who are rivals to Yahweh, are responsible for producing the Nephilim, and therefore are responsible for the later giant clans. This approach uses Yahweh's relationship to Abraham and Sarah as an analogy. Note, Sarah would have been well past the age of producing an egg for fertilization and the physical demands of bringing a child to term. End note. While there is no suggestion of a sexual relationship between an embodied Yahweh and Sarah to produce Isaac and, therefore, the Israelites, it is nonetheless true that the Israelites came about through supernatural intervention. Note. David E. Bakhovoy has recently put forth the idea that Yahweh is perceived as a sexual deity in the Old Testament. I do not believe a phrase like sexual deity captures the semantic point of Genesis 4:1. Bakhovoy argues that the verb in question in Genesis 4:1, kana, means to create or procreate. I would agree that the verb can certainly have this meaning. Bakhovoy's argument is that the biblical writer believed God participated in the mystery of procreation. Although he doesn't state it, his assumption appears to be that the biblical writers attributed conception to the deity because, unlike us, they didn't know scientifically how human fertilization and what happens in the womb worked. I would also agree with that point. However, Bakhovoy's conclusion that Yahweh actively participated in Cain's procreation needs qualification that he does not include in his work. One can say that, in the perception of the biblical writer and even Eve herself, God caused Eve's pregnancy. But what does that mean? The biblical writer wasn't ignorant of the man's, Adam's, involvement. The text of the first half of Genesis 4:1 says explicitly that Adam knew Eve his wife, and she, subsequently, conceived. In other words, the biblical writer understood that sexual intercourse between a man and a woman led to pregnancy. There is no prerequisite for modern scientific understanding for grasping that point. In the second half of the verse, Eve says, I have gotten, lema k, Kana, form Kaniti, a man with the Lord. But note that Eve is the grammatical subject of this sexual verb, not the object. Bakavoy's writing sounds as though Yahweh is the subject here, and that Yahweh is participating sexually with Eve. That isn't what the grammar of the text says. The author's wording lacks precision and is therefore misleading. Nevertheless, following Bakavoy for the sake of discussion, one could translate Eve's statement this way: I have procreated a man with Yahweh. What would this mean, since the writer clearly has Adam as the one having sexual relations with Eve? The answer is simple. This passage is akin to others in the Old Testament where the author narrates the fact that couples have sexual intercourse and then attributes pregnancy, that is, opening of the womb, to Yahweh. In other words, God gets credit for the mystery of procreation. This is neither complicated nor shocking, and it isn't proof that Yahweh was thought to participate sexually with anyone. The mystery of procreation and the act of intercourse are distinguished in Genesis 4:1 and other passages. End note. In that sense, Yahweh fathered Israel. The means God used to enable Abraham and Sarah to have a child are never described in the Bible, but Scripture is clear that divine intervention of some sort was necessary. The Bible's silence on the nature of the supernatural intervention opens the door to the idea that other rival gods produced offspring to oppose Yahweh's children. As we'll see in the following chapter, this belief on the part of the biblical writers, with respect to either approach, became the rationale for the extermination of certain people groups in Canaan. Either the giant clans are the result of literal cohabitation, or the sexual language is merely a vehicle to communicate the idea that, as Yahweh was responsible for Israelites' existence, so the giant clans existed because of some sort of supernatural intervention of rival gods. Note: reconciling the first view with what 2 Peter 2:4-10 and Jude 6-7 say about the angels who sinned is straightforward, especially given the sexual nature of the events of Sodom and Gomorrah, which both writers use as analogous situations. The second approach doesn't question the sexual language. It considers it euphemistic. Peter and Jude's inclusion of sexual language is no surprise. It is present in the Old Testament. This approach would argue that there is no reason to insist that Peter and Jude did not also consider it euphemistic. In any respect, what cannot be coherently denied is that Peter and Jude have divine beings as the offenders, not mere humans. End note. Both approaches therefore presume that the Nephilim and the subsequent giant clans had a supernatural origin, but they disagree on the means. Nephilim after the flood. Genesis 6:4 pointedly informs readers that the Nephilim were on earth before the flood and also afterward. The phrase looks forward to Numbers 13:33, which says with equal clarity that the oversized descendants of Enoch came from the Nephilim. The sons of Enoch, the Anakim, were one of the giant clans described in the conquest narratives. The text clearly links them to the Nephilim. But how is this possible, given the account of the flood? Note: the Hebrew of the phrase in Numbers 13:33 literally reads that the sons of B'nai Anak were from, min, the Nephilim. The meaning is either that the Anakim were lineal, biological, descendants, or were viewed as part of a group that descended from the Nephilim. Some have argued that the preposition min suggests that the Anakim were only like the Nephilim, but there is no clear instance in the Hebrew Bible for this semantic nuance. As Doak notes in his discussion of the phrase, whatever the case, the Anakim here are most certainly thought to be the physical, and thus moral or spiritual, descendants of the Nephilim. End note. The problem is one that has puzzled interpreters since antiquity. As I noted in chapter 13, Some Jewish writers presumed the answer was that Noah himself had been fathered by one of the sons of God and was a Nephilim giant. Genesis 6:9 clearly wants to distance Noah from the unrighteousness that precipitated the flood, so this explanation doesn't work. There are two alternatives for explaining the presence of giants after the flood who descended from the giant Nephilim. One, the flood of Genesis 6-8 was a regional, not global, catastrophe. Two, the same kind of behavior described in Genesis 6:1-4 happened again, or continued to happen, after the flood, producing other Nephilim from whom the giant clans descended. The first option, a localized flood, naturally depends on the coherence of the arguments in defense of a local flood, especially those arguments dealing with the wording in the biblical text that seems to suggest the flood was worldwide. Many biblical scholars, scientists, and other researchers have marshaled the evidence in favor of this reading. Note: the argument for a local flood proceeds along several trajectories aside from scientific arguments. Our concern is with the biblical text and its own evidence for a local flood. First, the phrases in the flood narrative that suggest a global event occur a number of times in the Hebrew Bible, where their context cannot be global or include all people on the planet. For example, the phrase, the whole earth, kol eretz, occurs in passages that clearly speak of localized geography. In such cases, whole land, or all the people in the area, are better understandings. Those options produce a regional flood event if used in Genesis 6-8, where the phrase occurs. Second, Genesis 9:19 clearly informs us that the whole earth was populated by the sons of Noah. Genesis 10 gives us the list of the nations spawned by the sons of Noah, all of which are located in the regions of the ancient Near East, the Mediterranean, and the Aegean. The biblical writers knew nothing of nations in another hemisphere, the Americas, or places like India, China, or Australia. The language of Genesis 10 therefore allows Genesis 7:21 to be restricted to only, or even some, of the people groups listed in the Table of Nations. That interpretation is consistent with a localized flood. Third, the phrase, all humankind, kol Adam, used in Genesis 7:21, also appears in contexts that cannot speak to all humans everywhere. For example, Jeremiah 32:20 and Psalm 64:9 can only refer to people who had seen what God had done, not people on the other side of the world. Lastly, Psalm 104:9 appears to forbid a global flood, since it has God promising to never cover the earth with water, as had been the case at creation. End note. For our purposes, this option would allow human survival somewhere in the regions known to the biblical authors, specifically the ancient Near East, the Mediterranean Sea, and the Aegean Sea. Note: both supernatural approaches to Genesis 6, 1-4 can accommodate a local flood. Both posit flood survivors, by whatever means, somewhere in the Mediterranean or Aegean, the known biblical world. Those survivors, at least some of them, would have had to eventually migrate to Canaan. At least one of the giant lineages can be traced to the Aegean, see chapter 25. In like manner, positing a post-flood origin for more Nephilim would require more divine intervention of the same undescribed type. End note. The second option is a possibility deriving from Hebrew grammar. Genesis 6:4 tells us there were Nephilim on earth before the flood, and also afterward, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humankind. The when in the verse could be translated whenever, thereby suggesting a repetition of these pre-flood events after the flood. Note: a translation of when takes the asher clause as temporal. According to Westerman, this is the view espoused by most commentators. He is, however, apathetic as to whether a temporal understanding or another possibility is more coherent. It does not really matter whether asher is understood as temporal with most interpreters, or iterative, so E. Conning, W. H. Schmidt, and others, or as causal, For example, B.S. Childs, against, and correctly, W.H. Schmidt. A share is an afterthought, its function being in fact only to link and to subordinate. Wenham notes that some Hebrew scholars consider the use of the Hebrew imperfect in this clause to allow for repetition. Whenever the sons of gods went into the daughters of men, they bore them children. Though it is not impossible to translate this as a simple past event, when they went in, it is more natural, with Skinner, Koenig, and Gispen, to take the imperfect went and the perfect preceded by the vav, bore children, as frequentive. To go into is a frequent euphemism for sexual intercourse. End note. In other words, since Genesis 6:4 points forward to the later giant clans, the phrasing could suggest that other sons of God fathered more Nephilim after the flood. As a result, there would be no survival of original Nephilim, and so the post-flood dilemma would be resolved. A later appearance of other Nephilim occurred by the same means as before the flood. All this sets the stage for Numbers 13. Fear of the giant clans results in a spiritual failure that means wandering in the desert outside the land of promise for 40 years. The generation who came out of Egypt is sentenced to die off outside of holy ground. The new generation under Joshua will wind up facing the same threat. Chapter 24. The Place of the Serpent. In Numbers 13, the Israelites had arrived at the border of Canaan. Moses sent 12 spies into Canaan to report on the land and its inhabitants. They came back with the news that what God had said was true. The land was flowing with milk and honey. But then added, "There we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." The very next chapter of the book of Numbers tells us that, despite the miracles of their deliverance from Egypt, the people refused to believe that God would help them defeat the Anakim, sons of Anak. Because they rebelled, God sentenced them to wander in the desert for 40 years until all who did not believe had died off. Only then would God bring them back to the promised land. Note. Some try to argue that the report of the spies was a lie or deliberate exaggeration motivated by fear. This is a poorly conceived idea, since it requires either ignoring all the other biblical references to giants, Anakim or otherwise, or considering them to be lies as well. It also requires removing the term Nephilim from its context and ignoring the morphology of the word. See chapters 12 to 13. There is no sound exegetical support for this idea. End note. Who were the Anakim? Were these giants the kind of monstrous beings we read about in Greek mythology? How many of them lived in the land? The text clearly connects them to the Nephilim, but how exactly were they connected? Answers to these questions can only be understood when framed by the original ancient context of the biblical writers who put the Old Testament account of Israel's history in its final form. It is no accident that, by all accounts, this work was finished in exile in Babylon. The biblical writers deliberately connect the giant clan enemies Israel would face in the conquest back to the ancient apostasies that had Babylon at their root, the sons of God, and the Nephilim, and the disinheritance of the nations at the Tower of Babel. These incidents inform the Israelite supernatural worldview. They are at the heart of what's at stake in the war for the promised land. Israel will encounter two deadly forces, the descendants of the Nephilim and the people of nations under the dominion of hostile gods. The two are, at times, conflated in the narrative. Both must be defeated, but one in particular must be annihilated. The Giants of the Transjordan. As the 40 years of wandering neared completion, God directed Moses to lead the new generation of Israelites, and the few members of the old generation whose faith had not failed, back toward Canaan. But instead of heading into Canaan from the south as before, God brought them alongside Canaan through territory to the east, the Transjordan. This was no accident. Deuteronomy 2 picks up the story. So we went on, away from our brothers, the people of Esau, who lived in Seir, away from the Harav road, from Elath to Ezion-Geber. And we turned and went in the direction of the wilderness of Moab. And the Lord said to me, Do not harass Moab, or contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession. The Emim formerly lived there, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim. The Horites also lived in Seir formerly, but the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. The Lord said to me, Today you are to cross the border of Moab at Ar, and when you approach the territory of the people of Ammon, do not harass them or contend with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot for a possession. It is also counted as a land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites call them Zamzumim, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau, who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place even to this day. As for the Avim, who lived in the villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and settled in their place. Deuteronomy 2:8-23. We learn several things of significance in this passage and its geography. Proceeding from south to north, the Edomites, Moabites, and Ammonites were to be left unmolested by the Israelites because God had long ago allotted that land to Abraham's nephew Lot and his grandson Esau, Jacob's brother. It is fascinating to note that giants had once lived in those territories prior to the arrival of Moses, Joshua, and the Israelites. These giant clans were known among the Moabites and Ammonites as the Emim and the Zamzumim. Other inhabitants had also been driven out, the Horites, the Avim, and the Kaphtorim. These tribal groups are never themselves referred to as being unusually tall, though they surface in connection with giant clans in a number of other passages. The thing to observe here is that these giant clans had already been removed from the land promised to Abraham's descendants by the descendants of Esau and Lot, who were also descended from Abraham, like Israel. These giant clans were related to the Anakim, who were, of course, from the Nephilim. We aren't told specifically how the bloodline lineages worked, but we are told a relationship existed. Additionally, all of these groups seem to also have been referred to as Rephaim, a term that will take on more importance as we proceed. Marching to Sihon and Bashan. God told Moses to ask travel permission of the sons of Lot and Esau as the Israelites journeyed northward through the Transjordan. They received that permission and passed through. They were on their way at God's leading to what was actually the last area under the dominion of the Nephilim bloodline in the Transjordan. Moses is seemingly unaware of God's aim in this leg of the journey. Deuteronomy 2 continues as Moses sends word to the enemy in God's crosshairs. So I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemot to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, Let me pass through your land. I will go only by the road. I will turn aside neither to the left nor to the right. You shall sell me food for money, that I may eat, and give me water for money, that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, as the sons of Esau, who live in Seir, and the Moabites, who live in Ar, did for me, until I go over the Jordan and into the land that the Lord our God is giving to us. But Sihon, the king of Heshbon, would not let us pass by him. For the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate, that he might give him into your hand, as he is this day. Deuteronomy 2:26-30. Did you catch the last line? God hardened the heart of Sihon. The wording is designed to make us think of God's battle with Pharaoh, the presumed god of Egypt. It was time for Sihon to go, but why target him? The answer to that question requires a look back into biblical history, and then a look forward into the next chapter of Deuteronomy. Let's look back first, to Abraham. In Genesis 15, one of the passages where Yahweh appeared to Abraham in the form of a covenant relationship with him, God told Abraham the following in a dream. Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Genesis 15:13-16. God told Abraham that his descendants, the people of Edom, Ammon, Moab, and of course Israel, would live in bondage, but would one day return to the land of promise, at a time when the iniquity of the Amorites had reached the point when God was ready to judge it. Why Sihon? He was an Amorite king, but why the Amorites? The historical material on the Amorites is sparse. Broadly speaking, the Amorite culture was Mesopotamian. The term and the people are known from Sumerian and Akkadian material, centuries older than the Old Testament and the time of Moses and the Israelites. The word for Amorite actually comes from a Sumerian word, Mar-tu, which vaguely referred to the area and population west of Sumer and Babylon. The use of Amorite in the Old Testament is indiscriminate. Note: in Genesis 14:13, an Amorite is said to have been an ally to Abraham. This is not much of a surprise, since the term could simply denote Mesopotamian ethnicity. But in the broad strokes of the conquest narratives, the Amorites are enemies, and their Babylonian heritage becomes a link back to the Nephilim. End note. In some passages, it is a label for the entire population of Canaan. In that sense, Amorites and Canaanites are interchangeable, both denoting non-Israelite in the land of Canaan. In other passages, its use is more specific to one people group among several within Canaan. Canaanites and Amorites were therefore generic terms used to describe the enemies of Israel. Of the two, Amorites takes on a more sinister tone in the context of the Babylonian polemic that precedes this point in Israel's story. Tarring and feathering the inhabitants of Canaan with a label that would take an Israelite reader back to the supernatural disasters of Genesis 6 and 11 would have a profound theological effect. But the connection is actually more direct than rhetoric. One passage in Scripture specifically connects the Amorites, Canaanites, to the giants that were derivative of the Nephilim. Note: the wording of Amos 2:9 cannot be conclusively isolated to reference only the individual Sihon or Og. The phrase the Amorite, he'emari, can refer to a single person or a collective. Whose is the simple relative pronoun esher? The third person singular suffix pronoun, his, fruit, can be used with respect to a collective as well, precisely because its grammatical agreement will align with the noun it represents. Since Amorite is morphologically singular, the suffix pronoun is singular. But the singular noun, as noted above, can be semantically plural. Consequently, the suffix pronoun would contextually be understood the same way. End note. God says through the prophet Amos, "Yet it was I who destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and who was as strong as the oaks. I destroyed his fruit above and his roots beneath. Also it was I who brought you up out of the land of Egypt and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite." Amos 2, 9-10. Note that the context for this statement is the Exodus and the conquest. That at least some Amorites were unusually tall would have been proof to the Israelites they had descended from the Nephilim. And that case, of course, was made in Numbers 13:32-33. For an Israelite, all this meant that the native population of Canaan had a supernaturally sinister point of origin. This wouldn't be just a battle for land. It was a battle between Yahweh and the other gods, gods who had raised up competing human bloodlines that were opposed to Yahweh's plan and people. Something else about Sihon factors into this interpretation. He was allied to a fellow named Og, another king of the Amorites who ruled in the region of Bashan. Og was a giant. Deuteronomy 3 tells us what happened after Israel's battle with Sihon. Then we turned and went up the way to Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to me, Do not fear him, for I have given him and all his people and his land into your hand. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon. So the Lord our God gave into our hand Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people, and we struck him down until he had no survivor left. And we devoted them to destruction, as we did to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, devoting to destruction every city, men, women, and children. But all the livestock and the spoil of the cities we took as our plunder. So we took the land at that time out of the hand of the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, from the valley of Arnon to Mount Hermon. The Sidonians call Hermon Sirion, while the Amorites call it Senir. All the cities of the tableland, and all Gilead and all Bashan, as far as Seleca and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bed was a bed of iron. Is it not in Rabbah of the Ammonites? 9 cubits was its length, and 4 cubits its breadth, according to the common cubit. Deuteronomy 3:1-11. For an ancient Israelite reader with a command of Hebrew, and a worldview that included the idea that supernatural opposition to Israel had something to do with pre-flood events in Mesopotamia, several things in this short passage would have jumped out immediately. None of them are obvious in English translation. First, the most immediate link back to the Babylonian polemic is Og's bed, Hebrew, Eres. Its dimensions, 9 by 4 cubits, are precisely those of the cultic bed in the ziggurat called Etemenanki, which is the ziggurat most archaeologists identify as the Tower of Babel referred to in the Bible. Note. Etemenanki equals Esagil, Sumerian. Brian Doak notes that scholars who have detected this connection conclude that the point of matching the dimensions was that the biblical writer wanted to compare Og with a cultic prostitute. This not only is an awkward referent, but fails to consider the wider Babylonian polemic connected back to Genesis 6. End note. Ziggurats functioned as temples and divine abodes. The unusually large bed at Etemenanki was housed in the house of the bed, Bit Ersi. It was the place where the god Marduk and his divine wife, Zarpanitu, met annually for ritual lovemaking, the purpose of which was divine blessing upon the land. Note. Sacred marriage rituals included the blessing of fertility for both the land and its inhabitants. The ritual was also concerned with maintaining the cosmic order instituted by the gods. Consequently, in addition to the giantism element, a link between Og and Marduk via the matching bed dimensions may also have telegraphed the idea that Og was the inheritor and perpetuator of the Babylonian knowledge and cosmic order from before the flood. This would, of course, tie him back to Genesis 6:1-4 and its Apkallu polemic. In any event, the size of Og's bed cannot be taken as a precise indication of Og's own dimensions. There is much more at play here. End note. scholars have been struck by the precise correlation. It's hard not to conclude that, as with Genesis 6, 1-4, so with Deuteronomy 3, those who put the finishing touches on the Old Testament during the exile in Babylon were connecting Marduk and Og in some way. The most transparent path